Well, good morning, everyone. We have a good number here again this morning. We're grateful that you've come our way. We have some that are visiting with us, some that have been here on numerous occasions that have visited with us. We're grateful that you've come back and returned to worship with us as well. But if you're here for the first time, we're also grateful that you're here, and we appreciate your presence. We have, so far for the month of January, and I'm doing something I said I probably wouldn't do this morning. I'm straying away from the pulpit just a little bit. But I want you to think back over the first few Sundays of this month now. We've been talking about improvement. And generally, with the way we do things after the new year, we set goals, we set make resolutions, things like that. And we've talked about commitment to the Lord and some other things along the way. This week, we're going to be talking about creating a servant's heart. I want you to think for just a moment about what was stated in that particular parable that was just read. And you think about the individual himself and the rich fool, as he's also so commonly called. Would you think that he had a servant's heart? And I want you to just stop for just a moment right there and think about a servant. What would you think? What would you deem as being a servant? Or who would you deem as being a servant? Because quite often we tend to wake up and have these fanciful ideas of what a servant is. Sometimes we immediately think of just someone who is a slave, who is bound and being drugged behind on a chain. And that individual that is suffering as a slave. Then you've got the idea of the butler and the maid and those types of servants that are hired. But do you ever think of yourself as a servant? Because quite often when we start talking about a servant, what do? We throw up our hands. Who, me? Well, think about this man right here in Luke chapter 12 for just a moment. And I look at him and everything that he did within this context was about who? It's all about himself, wasn't it? And so often we find ourselves bowing down to the monument that's most likable to us. And it's not the Washington Monument that I have up here. But there is a monument that we all bow down to at one time or another in our lives. And it is the monument of me, myself, and I. When I think about the idea that is set forth right here in Luke chapter 12, and I look at this gentleman right here, beginning at verse 16, and he was a rich man. The ground that he had planted in yielded a bountiful crop, more probably than he'd had in his lifetime. And all he could think about was what he could do for himself. He was bowing to that monument of me, myself, and I. It is such a popular monument that men have written books about it. It is such a popular monument that our society is encouraged to indulge themselves every chance we get. We are raising have raised a generation of children that if they are not narcissistic, they will be. But we have raised a generation of children who believe that they are entitled to everything and anything along the way. And that sense of entitlement that comes about with this has them bowing to the same monument that every man falls down to from time to time. As children of God, though, we need to change our attitudes. Just think for just a moment. There have been advertising campaigns that have come along and encouraged you to do simply for yourself. Do you remember the old Sprite campaign? Obey your thirst. Do you remember Burger King? Have it your way. McDonald's, you deserve a break today. Or maybe, ladies, you remember the old L'Oreal hair coloring commercials? Because I'm worth it. You know, why do we do things? We want to take care of ourselves. We don't always look at our lives and think of ourselves as servants because we are wrapped up and have fallen down at the monument of me, myself, and I. We have no problem exalting ourselves. We have no problem giving our self-worth or raising our self-worth to levels that are far beyond sometimes what they actually are. But we might become uncomfortable when God demands to be first in our lives. We might become uncomfortable when we have to realize that, yeah, I need to be a servant to God. But you know what? I don't want to give up everything that I'm giving myself. There's an old story that goes along something like this. I would like to buy $3 worth of God, please. Not enough to explode my soul or disturb my sleep. Just enough to equal a cup of warm milk or a snooze in the sunshine. I don't want enough of him to make me love a black man or pick beets with a migrant. I want ecstasy, not transformation. I want the warmth of the womb, not a new birth. I want a pound of the eternal in a paper sack. I want to buy $3 worth of God, please. Sometimes that's the attitude that we have. We don't overcome our prejudices. We don't look at fellow man as being important. We think about all we want to do is make ourselves comfortable. And I look back at this man in Luke chapter 12, and I see that very thing. And he thought within himself, what shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops? So he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. Me, myself, and I. Wrapped up into this nice little parable. And I will say to my soul, you have many goods. I can see this man straining to pat himself on the back. I can see this man standing in front of his servants that probably helped him harvest the crops and saying to them, look how great I am. I've seen other men in scriptures who have had this same attitude that cost them it greatly, just like it was costing this man. I think immediately of Nebuchadnezzar as king of Babylon, after God has given him everything that he did, and he looked around the great kingdom that he had and said, look what I have built. And he was cast off to live like an animal. I look at others, even in our day and time, if pride and ego are not problems, they are definitely hindrances to our being servants like we should. And so God desires of us to break the me syndrome in our lives. And how do we do that? How do we break that me problem that we have? Well, I want to suggest to you, David had a me problem. That me problem saw another woman that wasn't his wife and decided that he was going to take her, and he committed sin, adultery. That sin led to another sin of murder. That sin led to covering up the other sins that he had. And finally, it took one man to come to him and say, you're the man. Nathan the prophet did that. And David, in Psalm 51, presents a broken man. And when it comes to being a servant, what we have to end up doing is we have to break our own will in order to be able to serve God and to also to be a servants to one another. And what God wants from us is what David prayed for and what David said was necessary in Psalm 51 and verse 17. When he said, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. God told Jeremiah when he went to prophesy to Israel that he was going to have to tear down and then build up. And that's what the gospel does to us, whether we realize it or not. Gospel tears us down. We might not think about it that way, but it does just that. Think about the people on the day of Pentecost for just a moment. They heard this gospel message, this powerful message that Peter and the others were standing up and Peter was preaching. And all of a sudden, what happened to these people? What broke them at that particular time? because we're told they were pricked in the hearts. That's when you knew that their will had been broken. Then they cried out, "Men and brethren, what must we do?" It's real easy, isn't it, to read something like this and see it. But our wills, when we became children of God, you think about this for just a moment. We sing a song in our songbooks that starts out, "All of self and none of thee." But by the time we get to the last verse, it's "none of self and all of thee." It's that broken and contrite heart. It's that broken spirit that we've come to that point in our lives. And that's how we start eliminating the selfishness that keeps us from being true servants. So how do we get past selfishness to acquire the heart of salvation, or the heart of a servant, one who serves others, one who serves God? Well, for the remainder of our lesson this morning, we're going to talk about trying to figure out how to understand selfishness. Where did it actually come from? Recognize it and ask the question, is it in me? And then we're going to try to overcome it. Find ways to forsake it. And so let's begin with understanding selfishness. I think we all understand it. I mean, but we're going to find its origin if you get right down to it. Because if, in order for us to understand selfishness, we have to ask the question, where did it come from, or where did it originate? You know, back at in creation in Genesis chapter 1, we're told that God created man in His image. And what I want to suggest to you is that God did not create us to be selfish. God did not create us to simply think about ourselves and everything be about us. But it did occur. That was one of the things that came about when you consider everything that transpired back in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, you see Eve being tempted by the serpent. You see what takes place in her life. And all of a sudden, things changed. Eve was asked, "Is there anything God's told you that you cannot do?" He's told us that we cannot eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the midst of the garden. Because in the day that we do, we'll surely die. And the serpent would turn around and say, "Oh no, that's not going to happen. No, you look at that fruit over there, it's good. You're not going to die if you eat that fruit." And she looked at the fruit. And she saw that it was pleasing to her eyes. She reached up, and what did she do? She ate the fruit. What took place? For the first time that's recorded to us in Scripture, she bowed to the monument of me, myself, and I. Look, if you will, at 1 John chapter 2. What causes us to bow to that monument? The cause for our bowing down is our egos. It's our pride. It's wanting to be better often than what we actually are or think we can be. But when you look at 1 John chapter 2, and you look beginning at verse 15, where it says, "Do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, all three of those things," when you think about them, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life, who are they about? They are not about God. They are not about others. They are all about me. And that's what Eve experienced. And so what does it say there in the remainder of that verse? Is not of the Father, but of this world. That monument that we bow down to of me, myself, and I is not of God. We were created in His image to be His people, to be His servants, not to be egocentric. We were meant to be loving, caring, sharing individuals. Servants of God and servants of one another. The Adam and Eve were meant to complement each other. Selfishness became sin. Selfishness brought isolation from God. Selfishness can bring isolation between you and other people. Think about this. More than just the garden was lost to them. Selfishness continues to be that root of all sin then, and even in our lives. You think about the sins that we consider to be the most heinous: murder, theft. Who are those about? The individual that's committing the sin. And you think about any sin, it doesn't matter. You look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, you look at the list of sins of the work of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5, you look over in the book of Revelation and you see the list of sins, the things that will not enter into heaven. Those people that commit those sins, who are those sins all about? Not God. It's about what I want. It's about what I desire. It's my lust of the flesh. It's my lust of the eyes. It's my pride of life that motivates me to do those. And so what we have to be able to do is move past the I love me part of our lives. But we really have to not just ask where it came from. We have to ask this question. And we have to really give some serious introspective look at ourselves when we ask this question: is it in me? Well, I'm going to say, to some extent, it's in all of us. I can be pretty confident when I say that, because we have all done something at some time in our lives that was truly selfish. And one thing I do know, at one point in our lives, if we were not children of God, what we were doing was showing God that we rejected being His servant. And we were being selfish, because we are all sinners. So is it in me? Well, I want you to look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. I want you to look beginning at verse 1. Second Timothy chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. What you see Paul saying to Timothy now: but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. And this really, I don't think, was any earth-shattering news that Paul was proclaiming. This was something that he knew was going to take place. And it was evident that even while Paul's writing this particular letter, there are problems around the world. Perilous times are there. Persecution has arisen. People are going to be thinking about themselves. How do I know that? Because the very first thing that Paul mentions in this list is, for men will be lovers of themselves. Now pay attention how this list begins, because I believe that everything else that follows is predicated upon that first statement. If you are going to be a lover of self, it's easy to become a lover of money. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And when you think about being a true lover of yourself, you eliminate God. Go back to the parable there, Luke chapter 12. Who did that man that built bigger barns and stored up all that he had and praised himself and said, "Now you just eat, drink, and be merry," left God completely out of everything? I would recommend that he could have had, if he'd ever had an opportunity to read what Paul was writing, he'd have seen his reflection in these words that Paul is writing to Timothy. This is a looking glass that we can look into and we can examine to see whether or not selfishness is in us. In order to improve our lives and develop a servant's heart, we have to be able to eliminate what Paul is talking about right here. And look at this, verse 5, because I didn't finish the text. It says, having a form of godliness, but denying its power, and from such people turn away. Now think about that for just a second, because that's talking about people that give this false pretense of being something that they're not. Is selfishness in me. If we begin with lovers of self, everything else, it's like a snowball in our lives, becomes all about us. And when it's all about us, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger in our lives. We can improve our lives as servants of God by learning that we have the problem, and then we can take steps to overcoming selfishness, changing the attitude from "I love me" to "you matter." To God, you matter. Taking the focus off of myself and putting the focus on others. Becoming a servant. It's recognizing that selfishness is in me and understanding that when you really think about it, I can be truly miserable if I want to be. So I ask this question. Before becoming a servant right here, how do you think you can be miserable in your life? Let me give you some suggestions on how to be miserable. Think about yourself. Talk about yourself. Use "I" as often as possible. Listen greedily to what people say about you. Be suspicious. Be selfish. Expect to be appreciated. Be jealous and envious. Be sensitive to slights. Never forget a criticism. Trust nobody. Do only for others as they do for you. Shirk your duties whenever you can. Do as little as possible for others. Never forget a service you may have rendered. Demand agreement with your views on everything. Put the Lord on the back burner in your life. Just love yourself more. You can be a truly miserable person. But when you start doing what Paul begins to mention in Philippians chapter 2, you start becoming a servant. I believe that we can get rid of this attitude of me, 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 or we can remove the monument of me, myself, and I from our lives when we start looking at others differently. In Philippians chapter 2, the first four verses there, especially verses 3 and 4, the Apostle Paul to the church at Philippi gives a remedy. He begins in verse 1, he says, "Therefore, if there's any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord and of one mind." And I want to suggest that what he states in verse 2 is not possible when everything is all about me. And then he states in verse 3, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others." He's telling the Philippian brethren, other people matter. Unity comes when we learn to be servants to one another, when we look at one another. So how do we do this? How do we develop this? Well, let me suggest a few things, and the lesson will be yours. First, we have to assimilate. What I mean by that is assimilation, oftentimes might be considered a bad thing, especially if you're a Star Trek fan. If you're a Star Trek fan, the Borg would assimilate people and turn you into them. That's not what we're talking about. But we have to be among one another. There is this sense that of assimilation, like Paul is talking about within these verses, that we need to be of the same love, be of one accord, and of one mind. If you ever watched Star Trek and you knew anything about the Borg, that was one of their greatest assets. Even though they assimilated people, even though they brought people in, they all functioned as one. They all functioned as one body, as one mind in that cube that they all occupied. Now, they were forced to do that. As children of God, it's done voluntarily. We assimilate with one another to become of one mind, to be of the same love and one accord. Why? Because we work better together when we do this. Isolation is a relationship killer. When all we think about is me, or I'm just going to do things by myself, I'm not going to include anybody else, and You can ask my wife. I tend to get grumpy sometimes when I just want to do something with her, and I find out that, oh, I didn't realize we'd invited somebody else. I thought it was just us. I have a problem with it. I know I do. I'm not proud of it. And I don't always act that way. But we all have a problem with selfishness. We need more of each other, not less. And I know that I've preached that several times and in other lessons, but it's true nonetheless. It doesn't matter how many times it's said or how many times it's repeated. The truth of the matter is still there. We need each other. And the best way that we're going to get along is when we develop the servant's heart. How do I know that we need each other? I can look at Acts chapter 1 and verse 13 and 14. The disciples were together. I look at Acts chapter 2 and verse 42. They continued daily. What that meant that they had to be together if they were to continue daily in the apostles' doctrine, the breaking of bread and prayers, all of those things. They had to be together. I can look at Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25, and I know that we have a command to assemble together. So we need to assimilate. Oh, I don't know how long ago it was, but Paul Harvey, you all are familiar with him, reported once of a 73-year-old man who had been pinned beneath his farm tractor for 4 days and nights in driving rain and a terrible storm. Finally, some concerned friends went out to see, check on him. 4 days now it took them to check on him. He survived the ordeal. He lost a leg below the knee. And then several newspapers picked up the story and centered on the amazing fact that a 73-year-old man could live after being pinned beneath a tractor for 4 days and nights in such bad weather. What's even more amazing about the news report is the reason his friends were compelled to check on him. One fellow said it best. He missed worship services on Wednesday night. That's all. Yes, he was always faithful in attendance, that simply missing one service caused his brethren to check on him. That's the type of attitude that we need to have. Do we practice that all the time? We don't. I don't. Like I said, these lessons that I'm preaching this month are not just for a congregation of people that don't include me. I said last week, there are things that I need to improve on. This is an area I think everybody can improve on. Wednesday nights, I'll tell you to look around the auditorium. I haven't always followed my own advice and checked on people. We need to change because we need to have an attitude like these people. He missed one service on a Wednesday night, and they knew that he was always there. We need to stimulate one another. And I don't mean that we have to sit there with a sharp object and poke one another and prod each other that way. Sometimes we need a swift kick in the pants. But that's not what we're talking about here. We want to encourage. We want to have you have something of value to share with your brethren. And really what you need to be is you need to learn to be a giver. We talked about Hebrews chapter 10, and these lessons also, I hope you've noticed that it's impossible to do a series of lessons without some overlap in the lessons. We talked about improving our worship last week. Well, you can't improve your worship if you're not here. Because Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 24, the verse before Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25 that tells you not to forsake the assembling of yourselves together, tells you to consider one another, how you can provoke one another to love and good works. That's how we stimulate one another. We encourage one another. It's not just simply giving each other the attaboys. Look at Galatians chapter 6 for just a moment. If we are not aware of one another. We might miss something. We might miss something like this in Galatians chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. It says, "Brethren, if any man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourselves, lest you also be tempted." We might forget about the one who is trapped in sin, and we might have an attitude toward that individual that says, "Oh, that's just the way they always are." That's not the attitude of a servant. The attitude of a servant is reaching out to an individual and seeking to offer them help, to pull them out of the fire that they have fallen into that can destroy them eternally, to help restore soul. Just be careful that you don't fall into the same trap that they do. You look at verse 2. He goes on, "Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself." He goes on right there. He says, "Don't bow down to the monument of me, myself, and I." And then you say, "But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another." Well, that's the other thing. You don't always have to compare yourself to other people. "For each one shall bear his own load. Let him who is taught in the word, share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will also reap to the flesh corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." Here's the thing. Sometimes we throw up our hands. Sometimes we try to do good and we just don't think that it's benefiting anybody else, and we give up. We lose heart. And Paul's saying, don't. Keep on keeping on. Keep on being the servant. Keep on serving others. Keep on doing for others. You have value as a child of God. Share it. People want to know that others care. Show them. Give them loving, caring attention. Be genuine in the interest that you show. When you tell them you'll do something for them, take action and do it for them. Help one another. Encourage one another. Don't just say you love one another. Show you love one another. Participate. Last week, in the sermon that we talked about improving our worship, I made mention that there is nothing stated in Scriptures about being a spectator when it comes to worship. The same thing is absolutely true when we're outside of this building. When we are children of God and we're supposed to be serving one another in this capacity, we have to be participating with one another. It's sharing what you have is a practical way of showing that you have something to offer. Showing interest in others. I want you for just a moment, turn your Bibles to 1 John chapter 3. Beginning at verse 17. "But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him?" Well, I think that's a rhetorical question. Because when you ask that question, it can't. The love of God doesn't abide in him if you sit back and do nothing. "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." The same thing my wife has told me for almost 37 years. Don't tell me you love me. Show me you love me. That's a principle that you find within the Scriptures. Whether time is necessary to give, then give time. If it is talent, an ability that you have, use it for someone else. If it is the treasure that you have something to offer to others, be willing to share it. It has been said this way: do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you can. To improve our lives as servants of God, to become a servant, we have to break our wills and look at others before ourselves, and then never bow down to the monument of me, myself, and I ever again. I want you to consider this as we close this lesson this morning. That the heart of a servant is one that looks past itself to find what it can do for others. But the servant's heart is always viewing that which is eternal. Because you are first a servant of God. And so, before I leave you with Matthew chapter 25 and verse 23 to think about, remember who you are and whose you are. Because you want to hear these words: "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord." It is eternity. The stairway to heaven may not have as many people on it as we think it'll have. But those that will be on it, they will have been true servants of God and true servants of one another. Take out your songbooks. The song we're about to sing, "Hark the Gentle Voice," is the invitation song that is extended to you this morning. If you have a need of reconciliation to God in one way or the other, as a first time, if you need to be born again in the water of baptism, or if you need to reconcile a life that is strayed from God, we stand ready to assist you. And understand, it's not Brian Lockmiller's invitation. It is not the invitation of Park Hill Church of Christ. It is the invitation of our Lord to everyone that needs to come to Him with a broken spirit, with a broken and contrite heart. Break your will. Become a servant of the Lord today. Won't you come as together we stand and as we sing.